What I want to do this evening is to do two things, really. First of all, to make the case, the rationale for the work that we're doing on innovative learning environments and why we think it's a very important and relevant strand of international work. And then secondly, to outline some of the key conclusions and frameworks that have emerged and that have already emerged, drawing particularly on the nature of learning, the volume that Ishmael has mentioned. First, though, I just want, by way of introduction, I do want to say a couple of words about the OECD and education, since, as Ishmael said just now, there's a tendency to assume that we only started at OECD to become interested in education with the first PISA surveys. And this is not actually true. In fact, from the very first year of work, since the OECD was founded in 1961, there was the beginning of quite intensive work on education. I've put up there the fields, really, that defined that early work: educational planning, equity, the early nascent science of economics of education, and science itself. There was a great concern at the time that in the wake of the Sputnik crisis, that the OECD member countries, their science education was falling behind, particularly in the context of the Cold War. So those defined some of the very early preoccupations, which changed quite swiftly as the 1960s went on, and our center was founded in 1968. Again, not coincidence that in Paris in 1968, when there was so much turmoil, that there was also a readiness to think about the long term, think about different futures. And this really sums up our mission, really, which is to look ahead. It is to use international findings and examples, and it is to try and identify and stimulate innovation. So that gives you a sense of what we've been trying to do over the past 44 years in our center. And the work that I'm outlining to you fits very centrally in that mission. As Ishmael mentioned, I've been working on a big project on the future, Schooling for Tomorrow, and more latterly, this particular program on innovative learning environments, which has come out of the Schooling for Tomorrow work. So first of all, the rationale. Why learning, why innovation, why learning environments? First of all, why learning? I think it's perhaps something of a banality, or it sounds something of a banality now, to say that we live in a knowledge society, a knowledge economy. But although we hear it a great deal, it doesn't make it any less true. And to the extent that knowledge is central, then so is learning, necessarily. If knowledge is central, so is learning. But then, of course, that raises immediately the question, what kind of learning? What kind of learning are we interested in? And I'll give a partial answer to that in a moment. Coming back to PISA and similar preoccupations, there's been a very strong focus on measuring learning outcomes. And of course, that's related to my first question, what kind of learning? But understanding, measuring, surveying outcomes doesn't tell you how to change them. Once you've mapped patterns of achievement, you've understood some of the correlating background factors, it doesn't actually tell you how you can change those outcomes. And for that, we say we need quite a strong focus on the nature of learning environments themselves. A third factor, I've just mentioned three. I've come from France, so there's a kind of Cartesian thinking in threes. A third factor comes from a very strong pressure across all kinds of settings, countries, provinces, states, cities, to reform education. We're under a lot of pressure to reform. In many systems, there's a kind of reform fatigue, because there's been so many reforms and changes. And a sense of frustration, I think, in some quarters, that this doesn't bear more fruit, that there's been lots of change, lots of reforms, but somehow a sense that too much stays the same. And to my mind, that suggests the need to look afresh at the very heart of education, that is learning itself, how we organize it, how we teach to it, and so on. So those, I think, introduce, in terms of learning, why we at OECD are so interested in. Why innovation? Why put together learning and innovation? Well, one reason is that on these conventional measures, on these now well-known familiar measures, there are a great many of our young people who are not succeeding very well. And across the OECD as a whole, that's right across all the OECD countries, the 34 of them, that's about a fifth of 15-year-olds are not reaching the level two in reading, which is one of those international benchmarks that is often proposed to be a minimum international standard of the competence that we need to function in today's society. So there's a sense in which the innovation comes from actually looking at some fairly conventional indicators and saying, well, if the existing models, if the existing arrangements are not performing well enough, we need to be ready to innovate. We need to be ready and open to do things differently from how we do them. But I don't think we're just looking to improve within our established systems. I think increasingly there's a growing ambition for what learning should do. So we come back to that question I posed right at the beginning, but what kind of learning? And I think increasingly we're looking at least two or three aspects that are, that the need for innovation comes from the fact that we're getting more ambitious in general. We're in the 21st century. We realize these are complex, advanced societies and economies that we live in. Therefore, the learning that we're talking about is correspondingly complex and advanced. And I think we're talking now about learning going well beyond some kind of rather conventional understanding of a grasping factual material, if ever that was an adequate definition, looking now much more towards deep learning, the grasp of concepts, the grasp of material that can be used in different contexts, not just the context in which it's learned. Those famous competencies that are now often described as 21st century competencies, nothing peculiar to the 21st century in those. We usually mean problem solving, we mean innovation, creativity, the capacity to work together in teams, entrepreneurship and openness and curiosity. Those things that we call 21st century competencies, and particularly laying the foundation for lifelong learning. If we're living in knowledge society, learning society, then we need to become lifelong learners. And in the early years, we are in a crucial way laying the foundation for that. So it's not just that we're not doing the conventional things as well as we could, it's that we're expecting more and more. And that sets a real agenda for innovation. And as I say, thinking in threes, a third reason comes from the kinds of principles about the nature of learning that I'll be outlining in a minute. The evidence-based principles are sufficiently demanding that they call for a significant drive to innovate. So learning is central, and that is shared across many, many countries and settings. The drive to innovate is central. And then the question, why are we talking about learning environments? So learning, innovation, why learning environments? That's, I think, the first reason. We understand increasingly the extent to which learning is something that is accumulated. It's something that's in a crucial way contextualized. It's something done in context. And from the learner perspective, this means that we must think of learning in a holistic way. And we feel that the notion of a learning environment helps us to get out of the rather fragmented ways we often think in terms of education, and to try and capture and understand in a holistic way the learning experience as a whole. I think we need to think in terms of learning environments for the rather familiar but no less important fact that the advances in technology and the ubiquity of now inexpensive, very powerful technology invites the rethinking of the possibilities of learning and teaching, although in general there's a sense that there's still quite a long way to go for that potential to really be fully integrated into our learning environments. Nevertheless, I think there's a widespread perception that that has changed quite significantly the challenge that we have. And thirdly, we talk about learning environments because however important schools are, and I'm a great believer in schools, I think they're crucial and very important institutions, it's clear that we're talking often about learning that is not always taking place within schools. We're talking about non-formal learning, informal learning, hybrid learning environments. We just finished a paper at OECD on the notion of hybrid learning environments. In other words, if we're too stuck in the institutions of school, we're not thinking sufficiently in a sufficiently open way to capture the complexity of the ways in which we are now learning in society. So that's pushing us, we feel, towards talking about learning environments and less talking about schools themselves. There's a further reason. Let me put this up. This looks a very simplistic framework, and of course, in some respects it is. System at the top. People say, well, what are you talking? Are you talking about the system level, the school? Yes, system at the top, school, class, teacher, learner. It's a very common framework. It's a common framework not just in everyday discussion about education, but in research, in quite sophisticated research. This very simple framework is often what is defining the agenda and the frameworks of our questions. We think that that is actually a rather misleading framework for some of the reasons I've outlined, but which I can encapsulate in this way. So why look beyond that rather straightforward, unidimensional, vertical framework when our focus is on learning? First of all, it's expressed very much in terms of institutional structures, systems, schools, classrooms, and it's not about how learning itself is organized. It's the starting point are buildings, institutions, facilities, and organizations. And we think that we need to turn it round. Those, of course, are very important, but we need to start thinking more in terms of how learning itself is organized and then how that works in different institutional and organizational settings. So a first reason why we think that rather simple framework is not so helpful when it comes to thinking about learning is it's not sufficiently focused on learning itself. A second reason is that it assumes essentially that the institutional arrangements that we have now are the best ones for the future. We start with schools, classes. We think that's where we're going to be the relevant framework to think in terms of organizing learning, and it discourages consideration of innovation. So essentially, it's not sufficiently about innovation itself. It's not enabling us to think sufficiently about what alternatives might be that, of course, might fit into schooling and school systems. And perhaps even more important than either of those two reasons, when we're talking about the system, the school, the teacher, the classroom, these are very individualistic concepts. And they throw us back into thinking about things in terms of, say, the teacher, in terms of things like individual skill sets, individual competencies, rather than what teachers collectively can achieve together, collaboratively. And that was what I was saying earlier on, one of the reasons why I think the notion of a learning environment and thinking more collectively, more holistically, is very important. So those, if you like, sum up, not sufficiently learning-focused, not sufficiently about innovation, and not holistic enough, are reasons why we feel we need to think somewhat beyond that rather simple framework and start thinking about organizing learning itself. So that takes me to the second part, and main part perhaps, of what I want to say this evening. And it's about our innovative learning environment project and about the principles of learning that we've derived in the first part of that work. I'm not going to say too much about the project itself, but just to say that it really is about trying to internationally inform practice, leadership and reform. I put all those in there because we are interested both in terms of providing analyses, materials and exchanges that will be helpful to people who are working in the field, those who are school leaders, teachers, experts who are in the field, students and parents as well, if they're interested, we're delighted, but also in terms of those who are working in the area of policy and who are trying to change things through policy change. So we're wanting to address all the key players in our work, and we're doing it through work on learning research first. Secondly, looking at innovative cases. We've gathered quite a number of those. And thirdly, to move into the area of how do we grow and sustain innovative learning. I put that up not because the way in which we organize a project is terribly interesting, perhaps, but I think the approach that we've come to of wanting to combine research on learning research with inspiring examples that might help us to show the way and to then locate that and embed that in understanding different strategies and initiatives for moving beyond the individual isolated case to much more systemic change. I think that's a framework that we think is quite powerful. And we've so far got published results on the first of those, which I will tell you most about, on learning research. We're in the process of writing up our second, trying to digest the around 125 cases you see at the bottom there, the case studies, and the many countries, states, and organizations that are participating with us. And that's been quite an important part of this work. We've sought to engage a large number of countries, states, and organizations so that it's not based on a very small club of those who want to take part. We're very keen that this extends beyond a small number of countries. So that's the approach that we've taken. And that first publication is put up there. I'm so proud of the cover that I can't help but include it in a presentation. OECD books are not known for their visual appeal, and often they're rather boring presentation. For once, we've managed in our SERI to come up with a cover that I think captures something of the freshness. And what we sought to do was to get some of the leading experts in the world. And I say that really quite advisedly. We managed to get some really top researchers and thinkers from Europe and North America to contribute to that kind of a framework that you see there. So, for example, on emotions, Monique Bocarts contributed a chapter. Formative assessment, Dylan William from London. Technology and learning, Rick Mayer from California. Bob Slavin, Linda Darling-Hammond, Jim Spillane, and Lauren Resnick. In other words, we managed to get some real authorities to help us to do two things, to digest important and large bodies of research into an accessible scale, and to think about what that means for the design of learning environments. So that was what we asked each of them to do. And then in the final chapter, the future directions, we wanted to get away from the fragmentation of so much of this work to pull together the transversal strands that cut right across these different analyses. And that's what we did in that final chapter, and which I'll present to you now. So, pulling together all that different research, part, some of it rather theoretical, some of it very much applied about working in groups, technology, working in the community, and learning in the family, and so on, we think there are seven principles that should underpin powerful learning environments. And we think that all of them are important. The first one is about making learning central. Again, it's something that perhaps one would think doesn't need to be said, but it does need to be said. Making learning very much the central business of our education organizations, which is very much about encouraging engagement, the engagement of learners, and of finding a whole set of strategies so that learners come to understand themselves as learners, so that learning and a very explicit and conscious exercise of the business of learning becomes absolutely central. There's, I think, quite a common image. This is the second one, about the importance of the social nature of learning. There's quite a common image of learning that it somehow goes on inside people's heads, that it's a rather private and rather hidden exercise. It's clear from the research the extent to which learning is something very social. It depends on interaction, it depends on negotiation, depends on construction with your environment. And often the very most effective forms of learning are collaborative, learning together. Not necessarily all the time. There's very much a position and a role for self-study and autonomous learning, but that it is really important to recognize the extent to which learning is something social and often collaborative. The key role of emotions in learning, I think, is something to underpin. And by emotions, we mean things like the satisfaction and the enjoyment on the positive side that learning can bring, or the anxiety or the feeling of being lost, or the negative emotions that can come when things aren't working well. Now, I'm not talking now about how to be nice to students. That's not at all what this is about. Although, of course, it's better if we are nice to students. It's better than being nasty to them. But we're not talking about being nice to students. We're talking about the fact that effective learning really does require people to engage in learning, not to be anxious, to be motivated, and that is as important. It's the flip side of cognitive development. But in our discourse and in our debates in education, it often takes a very much a secondary position compared with the cognitive development, the standards, and so on. It's a flip side. It's the other side of the same coin. And this is, I think, something very important to understand. The next two I put together because they're in some sense they do go together. And I think they're some of the most challenging aspects of that research on learning, the extent to which learning environments need to be acutely sensitive to individual differences. And one of the most important differences across groups of learners is what they bring with them to their learning, their prior knowledge, their prior experiences, their values, their baggage, if you like. So the sensitivity to those differences is critical. And that fifth principle that we couple it with about being demanding for each learner goes with that. The need for learning environments to avoid, on the one hand, that there are learners who are coasting, who are not being challenged on the one side, and that there are learners who are lost on the other. And once you've lost learners, they will not engage, they will not be learning. But the research also shows that excessive overload, excessive pressure, it does not work. So how to be demanding, how to be challenging, but at the same time, how to avoid regimes of grind and of excessive pressure, thinking if we just push them harder, that's gonna do. We'll just ram a bit more in. That's not the way to go. Assessment is an absolutely critical part of any learning environment, any part of any education system. It's really important to know what's happening, who's learning what, who's not learning. But clearly, the key role of assessment is when it is consistent. The assessment regimes are consistent with what you're trying to do. So in terms of that kind of deep learning that I was talking about before, of 21st century competencies, foundations for lifelong learning, the question is, do we have assessment regimes that are really helping us to capture that? Do we have assessment regimes that really are helping us in a very formative way understand the nature of engagement, the extent to which learners are, differences are being recognized, and so on? So assessment critical, but it has to be assessment that genuinely captures what we're trying to do, with a strong emphasis on formative feedback. Feedback, absolutely critical. And then the final one is about making connections. In the book, we call them horizontal connectedness. And that's about making connections between any episode of learning and the bigger concepts that we're trying to develop. We're trying to develop an understanding of in learning episodes that build into something bigger. Are we doing that, or are we teaching particular episodes in a rather fragmented and rather isolated way? Are we sufficiently making connections across different subjects, across the disciplines? Are we working sufficiently with projects that really bring together cross-disciplinary learning that correspond to real-world and authentic situations rather than the somewhat artificial situations that we have in our different subjects and disciplines? And are we making a sufficient degree of connection between the learning that goes on inside and outside of school, so where a great deal of the learning is now taking place? So those are our set of seven principles. And as I say, we think it adds up to a rather demanding agenda because we're not talking about picking and choosing among those, but actually trying to do all of them at once. Re-expressing those principles in rather more familiar language, I think, gives us these kinds of conclusions. I think one can characterize those principles in terms of them being learner-centered, but to emphasize immediately that something being learner-centered, a school, a class, a program being learner-centered, is in no way in contradistinction to the key role of teachers and teacher professionalism. In fact, without highly professional teachers, I can't see how you can have very strong learner-centered learning environments. And that second point, the importance of structure and design, is part of that. When we're talking about inquiry-based learning, talking about group learning, it's actually very demanding of the professional repertoires that teachers need by themselves or with colleagues or with others to make work. So, in fact, we're talking about careful design and high levels of professionalism. What those principles define, it seemed to me, to add up to to learning environments that will be profoundly personalized. If we're talking about sensitivity to individual difference and strong regimes of formative feedback, that is an engagement by learners, that's personalization very much so. Inclusive, the very need to be sensitive to group differences, to make sure that some are not lost, some are not already outside and not learning, is precisely that we need to be inclusive. We need everybody to be engaged and to be learning. And social, that learning is effective in groups, and that there's the establishment of learning communities within schools and in the broader community around schools. So those re-express those principles in rather more straightforward terms that we understand in education. Now, I want to finish. I think I've got another 5 or 10 minutes still.
Ten minutes.
I've talked a lot about learning environments, so I want to say a little bit more about what we understand those to be and the frameworks in which we feel that they should be cast. I've talked about learners being central, and I think that is crucial. But learners understood in terms of the learning that goes on in the interaction between the teachers, and those are, I put in inverted commas, because some of those teachers will not necessarily be the qualified teachers in a system. Some will be the artist, the parent, the expert, the other student. In some of the learning environments, there's a lot. Peer learning is something, and peer teaching is something very important. So the importance of the interaction between, and in terms of resources, we're talking about the resources of space, the learning spaces, and the resources of technology in different ways, the digital resources, the educational materials. In terms of content, of course, the kind of knowledge, the kind of skills, and we can see in a number of the learning environments that we're addressing very deliberate attempts to introduce 21st century competence into their content, sustainability questions, values, citizenship, and so on, as being a very important part of the content. So the interaction between those in terms of the mixes of activities and pedagogies. Complex and dynamic learning environments seem to us to need a very strong understanding of learning leadership. We're talking about making learning change happen. We're talking about design and redesign. And therefore, the concept of learning leadership, and that's something that we're working with the foundation on right now to try and clarify what that means in this kind of context, what that means and what some of the important ingredients are and practices are, is critical. So I think the notion of learning leadership, in distinction to more general managerial understandings of leadership, is a very important one set in this kind of context. That leads to particular types of learning, which we can evaluate, we can measure in a number of ways that we need to be very aware of. We need an information-rich set of learning environments that are very cognizant of what is actually happening in terms of learning. And very importantly, there needs to be the feedback of that information, of course, to teachers, of course, to students, but particularly back to, if you like, that learning leadership, so that that critical information about what's happening can create not just formative assessment in the classroom, but that a learning organization is itself formative, formative in terms of understanding itself, understanding the learning that's taking place. Powerful learning environments will be applying in that circle, and particularly in that interaction between the learners, teachers, resources, and content through different pedagogy and activities, those seven principles that I put up before. The innovation comes in terms of being ready to rethink those core components and those processes. And the the need to constantly generate and use information formatively can inform active learning leadership. So that circular set of processes and that framework for us is a more convincing way when we're talking about learning of thinking about certainly at the micro level, and we're very interested at the moment, I'll come to other levels in the final slide, seems to us to be more convincing than thinking in terms of the school, the teacher, the classroom, the teacher, the learner. Of course, that's important, but we need to have something more learner-focused if we're going to really address the organization and configurations of learning. So that's the framework that we're working with. That defines, if you like, our learning environments. We think it's very important that we, at that micro level, we look for different strategies, routines, organizational ways of trying to make sure that the institutional environments in which learning takes place and that kind of learning environment that I put up are as far as possible working together. And we know that in educational research there's a lot of discussion about the grammars of schooling, and that's been a term used to describe how often schools can function in ways that pull back those high ambitions and go back to routines that are familiar because there's vested interests in not changing. There are whole varieties of ways, including through learning leadership, but in terms of whether they're learning walks, whether they're lesson study, learning study in Japan or Hong Kong, that are ways of trying to bridge between institutions and the way we organize learning to try and make sure that there's synergy at the micro level, not that we've got organizations pulling at cross purposes with what we're trying to do in learning. Of course, we can talk about sort of an atomic level, really, what's happening in individual classes and learning episodes. But our feeling is that it's very helpful to see that in terms of the environment rather than to focus at very much at that atomic level. Of course, you need to do that. You need to understand pedagogy. You need to understand the very micro level, the atomic level, as one might call it. But in terms of a wider systemic framework, we think it's very helpful to see that very, very micro activity in terms of learning environments and institutional environments in which they're embedded. This is perhaps the level that I think is most neglected, what we call the meso level, which is very much about networks and environments, networks between environments and communities of practice. And we're convinced that that level, that meso level, that networking level, is the really critical one when it comes to making change happen on a wider scale. All of this is not in any way to neglect the key role of policy and of those who are charged with actually making reform and change happen. But I think it somewhat recasts some of that role into thinking about how can we provide leadership in terms of what we're trying to do, how can we create the conditions, the incentives, and the capacity to really develop learning environments that are dynamic around those seven principles in the way that I described. And in particular, how can we encourage the meso level connections? How can we encourage that schools work together, that educators work together? It seems to me that you will never get scale unless that is encouraged. It's always going to be at the individual micro level that change will happen, and that will necessarily limit the extent to which you can really make a significant difference. So to sum up, I'm almost there. I think we need to be ready to rethink learning and be ready to innovate. We need to accept, I think, those challenging agendas. I think we need to draw on research and practice in order to create and sustain learning environments that put learning first. We need to look at ways to ensure that what some people call the technical core, the learning that goes on, is not at odds with the organization in which it takes place. We need to think about how to go to scale by developing that MISO level, and that's what we're very much focused on in the third strand of our project, and perhaps I'll come back in a couple of years and tell you some of those examples of how people are really trying to grow innovation through networking and communities of practice. And we need system-level leadership that will create favorable conditions and capacity for that micro and meso-level change.